The Flea Circus performing Tresses and Luke Kennard reading his conceptual art last Saturday night up in the Elgar Room. Poems from Luke Kennard's collections The Harbour Beyond the Movie and The Migraine Hotel. Jack Davis's Flea Circus is Jack Davis trumpet, Rob Cope clarinet and bass clarinet, Aidan Shepherd accordion and James Opstad bass. And you might like to know the next Proms Plus Late Music and Poetry is in the Elgar Room after the second of those Bernard Haitink, Emmanuel Axe, Brahms concerts on Saturday night. Well, if you've just switched on, welcome to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, and the second layer in this club sandwich of a prom being given by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Litton. After Bach's, it's Bartok and the piano concerto, which completes this season's prom cycle, the second in which the soloist will be Yuja Wang, who's making her prom's debut tonight. Now, Bach's symphony was finished in 1926 and first performed in 1929, and it was exactly in those years that Bartok's career as a solo pianist was at its height. He'd written his first piano concerto and other pieces to use in his concerts, and sabbaticals from his teaching job at the Conservatoire in Budapest allowed him to tour both the United States and the Soviet Union. He began to realise that audiences, orchestras and conductors all found the first concerto quite a hard nut to crack, so he decided to write a new concerto along the same lines, but rather more accessible for all. Well, I asked Yuja Wang, how difficult a piece is it really for the pianist?
Well, I think after all the concertos I've learned, this is probably the hardest one I've ever played, both for physically and musically, because you work really hard, but it's not exactly very pleasing to hear. But that's what I thought in the beginning, but the more I look into it, I really like the color. Mm. And it's kind of like the flavor, really spicy flavor into it, and no matter how hard it is physically, I'm trying to bring out the character and different, I don't know, the night music in the second
movement. It's an amazing sound world, Bartok.
Exactly, world, very mysterious, very biting, and lots of sound that we'll never hear from other composers.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah, it's definitely a fun piece, and the more I play, the more I delve into it, more stuff comes out. And I like Bartok because it's so close to nature. You know, you hear the contrapunto, it's like a wheel, it's a circle, circular, everything's like a wheel of life, and the night music is close to nature, so it's cool, yeah.
Yuja Wang, tonight's soloist. Well, like the first concerto, the second owes quite a debt to the neoclassical Stravinsky. The piano used percussively, wind and percussion playing important roles. In fact, the colourful first movement of Bartok's concerto is accompanied solely by wind and percussion. Accompanied is not really the right word, though, because Bartok specifically said he intended completely equal roles for piano and orchestra in his concertos. The strings join in for the central slow movement, which is set in a different world, a starry night on the endless Hungarian plain. Night music, as Yuja was saying. The piano's monologue is tender. It carries echoes of the similar mood in the slow movement of Beethoven's fourth piano concerto. Well, the movement may begin and end slowly, but the music frames a fast, demonic and eerie scherzo, which is at the heart of Bartok's piece. And in the finale, the full orchestra joins in properly for the first time. The playful music, a kind of variation of that in the first movement, synthesizing all that's gone before and leading to a joyful conclusion. And just as before Bach's, we heard Copland. Before Bartok, as Ed Seckerson was saying, we hear Barber's Adagio for strings. It was the piece that made Samuel Barber's name, courtesy of the conductor Toscanini in this case, who'd asked the young American for something he could program with his NBC Symphony Orchestra. Barber sent him the Adagio, which was an adaptation of the slow movement of his string quartet. To his dismay, the score was returned to him without comment, but it turned out Toscanini had already memorized it. The Adagio was the first American work recorded by him, and by the end of the Second World War, it was being performed everywhere. So, the strings of the Royal Philharmonic already and waiting on the platform. And here comes Andrew Litton to open this second part of tonight's BBC Prom by conducting Barber's Adagio for Strings.
Thank you.
The slow movement of Barber's String Quartet in the version he made, which became his most well-known piece. The Adagio for Strings, performed to open the second part of tonight's Prom live on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Litton. Well, the original String Quartet version, of course, rather intimately romantic, but in its orchestral incarnation during the Second World War in America, it became seen as a dignified piece to honour the nation's dead. And it was last performed in this hall during the last night of the Proms 10 years ago. A very different evening in the immediate aftermath of the carnage of 9/11. I was in the neighbouring box presenting the concert for BBC World Service, the American Leonard Slatkin conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and it felt entirely appropriate to that amazing and amazed occasion. Well, back to the present, and the piano lid, as you heard, has just been lifted. Took two of them to do it tonight. And the strings of the RPO are gradually being joined by woodwind, brass, percussion for Bartók's second piano concerto. Very full stage all night tonight, just for that adagio. We had a momentary hiatus. Well, it's when I came in, Yujo Wang was practicing in her dressing room, and she has just extraordinary dynamism and physical composure in the face of this amazingly difficult piece. I mean, I don't know what Bartók thought he was doing, trying to write a slightly easier work than the first piano concerto. As she said, it's the most difficult thing she's ever learnt. She's just 24. She began studying the piano when she was six. Her earliest public performances took place in China, Australia and Germany, and she studied at the Central Conservatory of Music in Beijing. Cleo Gould managing to play an A. Slight giggle as she does so from her, which is well nice. She then went from 1999 to the Morningside Music Summer Programme at Calgary's Mount Royal College, artistic and cultural exchange programme between Canada and China. She moved to Canada. She's now living, though, in the United States. Her debut, well, just 2005 with the National Arts Centre Orchestra, conducted by Pinchas Zukerman. But of course, that was 6 years ago, and that made her just 18. Well, we're just waiting for Yujo Wang and Andrew Litton. And if you think you recognise the trumpet fanfare near the beginning of this piano concerto, and it's music that keeps cropping up through the piece in various versions, it's Bartók cleverly speeding up the grandiose theme that ends Stravinsky's Firebird Ballet. See if you can spot it. So now here comes Yujo Wang in scarlet and gold, you could say, followed by Andrew Litton, joining the RPO on the platform here in the Albert Hall to perform Bartók's second piano concerto. Thank you. A joyfully raucous close to Bartok's second piano concerto, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3 by Yuja Wang, making her BBC Proms debut with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Lytton. When she stands up, you realise what a tiny figure she is and the amazing musculature she has to put what she does into that performance. And immediately went to Andrew Lytton to thank him and to Cleo Gould, and wanted the orchestra to stand immediately, and has left the stage very quickly, slightly overwhelmed by it all, and as you heard, the warmth of that reception. Bartok finished it in 1931, the concerto, only performed it 2 years later. The world was changing, the Depression had decreased his concerts as a pianist. He was earning his living largely by teaching the piano in Budapest. First performance in Frankfurt under Hans Rosbaud. Bartok very nervous, having not played in public. The orchestra wasn't very good, and a week later Hitler became Chancellor. Well, he was it was played across Europe. He gave the Proms premiere with Henry Wood in the mid-1930s. I wonder what he'd have thought of this 24-year-old, Yuja Wang. After that first performance, Richard Capel wrote in his review for the Monthly Musical Record of London, "Bartok cannot be quite so sad, mad, bad a dog as he makes himself out." Well, I think Yuja will need the holiday she's having after this. She's going to Paris for a couple of weeks. Then she's off to play with her friends, the Cappuccinos, as she calls them, Gauthier and Renaud Capucin, playing Mendelssohn and Beethoven in Dubrovnik. Back she comes, as you can hear, with Andrew Lytton applauding her as she comes. There's a grin on her face now. As I say, in a crimson gown with gold necklace. Neat hair. And the percussion, who plays such an important role in the concerto. As Bartok said, the orchestra is as important as the soloist. Yuja Wang leading the applause for the orchestra and the wind and the strings. She'll be doing a few more of these. She's off to Brazil to play Prokofiev, and to Norway to play the Bartok second, and indeed also to Rome with Antonio Pappano to play this concerto. But she's learning lots of stuff: the Brahms second, Chopin piano concertos, Beethoven Brahms sonatas, Bach suites, and she's very excited to be making her Carnegie Hall debut and taking part in Daniel Barenboim's series in Berlin. It's all go for this 24-year-old, who remains unfazed, it's unfazed, and remarkably like your average 24-year-old. Just with flying fingers and an amazing brain. Back she comes. This was, after all, her Proms debut. I think she might want to come back. Yuja Wang takes her bow, and Andrew Lytton gets the orchestra up behind her. Yuja Wang mouths thank you at the packed arena. Well, we've reached our second interval in this tripartite prom. Do stay with it. After it, the RPO and Andrew Lytton return to perform a work commissioned by the conductor whose presence towers over the genesis of much of tonight's programme and so much 20th century music, Serge Koussevitzky. It's Prokofiev's Fourth Symphony. Now, Bartok didn't like cities, but Prokofiev did. It's 50 years since Jane Jacobs published The Death and Life of Great American Cities, using the streets of her own neighbourhood of Greenwich Village in New York as a model. Jacobs offered a vision of urban life which ran counter to the prevailing modernism in its embrace of chaos and complexity. Well, for the next 20 minutes, in The Death and Life of the Streets, the writer Lindsay Hanley transposes Jacobs from Greenwich Village to South Wales and the streets of Cardiff Bay. And there she reflects upon the enduring relevance of Jane Jacobs and the ideas contained in her most influential book.
When I look through the window and see these new buildings coming up, it makes me feel out of the way a little bit.
All the people are happy and gay. They're building new houses in Tiger Bay.
The breaking up of the old houses and these new ones that they are building broke the melody of the place.
Hurrah, hooray, they're pulling down Tiger Bay. Oh, what a pity for
It takes a certain kind of person, I think, to be enchanted by city life. And some people merely put up with it for economic or pragmatic reasons. But others find in cities a richness and diversity that they feel is lacking elsewhere. I know I'm one of those people. And Jane Jacobs, the writer, loved cities, specifically her city, New York, to which she dedicates her most famous book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, which was published 50 years ago this year. Her book describes in loving and, to a great extent, I think, practical detail, the ingredients required to make a city work for the people who inhabit it. What she describes is a most intricate and close-grained diversity of uses that give each other mutual support, both economically and socially. That close-grained diversity, she argues, can't be planned for or imposed from above. It's got to grow organically over time, out of what people do already to make livable lives for themselves in a densely populated urban setting. People do live, work and raise children in cities, and they do make it work with the aid of very local and intensely used resources. To Jacobs, streets and street-based neighbourhoods function as they've evolved, which is to secure three major functions. First, they keep people safe through being constantly used. Second, they keep the economic life of the neighbourhood going because people shop and use the services that are closest to them. And third, they help people to be happy through familiarity and reciprocity and a consistent sense of place. Now I want to see if I can find these qualities in this vast new development at Cardiff Bay, where I'm standing now. It's an urban regeneration project which included the creation of a huge barrage that's turned a tidal lagoon into a huge flat freshwater lake. I wonder how much of the optimistic and human scale spirit of Jacob's book has been imbibed by the people who planned this development. Now at first glance, you feel like you could be anywhere. I'm standing on the barrage right now on a kind of mildly windy day, and I'm looking directly out at the redeveloped Cardiff Bay, which is full of flats and shops and restaurants. Right at the front is the Welsh Millennium Centre, right in front of the Welsh Assembly Building. To the left of that, I can see the Wales Millennium Stadium, and also to the forefront, the five-star St David's Hotel. The barrage seems to have been created purely for aesthetic reasons, so that people living in the flats and staying in the hotels and eating in the restaurants can have something nice to look out at, in a place where originally much of the day this area would have been completely devoid of water and purely mud. Now, knowing about the barrage and knowing that this lake is entirely man-made, it does make you realise that this area lacks something of the organic qualities that Jane Jacobs so lionised in her book. I'm going to go on a walk around the Cardiff Bay area to try and find out whether I can mentally knit what is in Jacobs' book about the principles of street life and about organic evolution of communities, whether they can be applied to the flats that I'm looking at now, which are gated and which are very uniform looking and appear to be very, very overly planned and planned from the top down. And I guess what I want to find out is whether, when large-scale developments like these are planned, whether those principles of human-scale development and natural growth and local services really are applied in this area, and whether they can grow over time. I'm going to start my walk at Mermaid Quay, which is the main commercial and leisure area of the bay, but I'm actually going to get there by boat.
All your fares across to Mermaid Quay. If you do have the correct change or your tickets are made, it'll be helpful, thank you. Now on our left-hand side over there, behind the wetlands area, is a row of Georgian terraced houses. Now before the barrage was built, this was a very run-down area of Cardiff. You can get two things here, and they were both illegal. One of those houses could be sold for about £8,000. 6 months after the barrage was completed, one of those houses was sold for £350,000.
Jane Jacobs' home was Greenwich Village, which is a densely populated inner neighbourhood of Manhattan, New York. And she regarded Greenwich Village as the very exemplar of how cities can and should and could work with sufficient vigilance, I think. And going back to her idea of the diversity of uses in a city neighbourhood, really what she meant was the fact that you have people living and working, going to school and socialising all in the same place. And I think some of her ideas have filtered through into the common keyword or idea of the mixed-use development, which is a phrase which is used to apply to all sorts of urban regeneration projects in Britain and around the world, and has been for the last 25 years or so. And the mixed-use development, similarly, is meant to contain, you know, leisure opportunities, cinemas, restaurants, workplaces, possibly government buildings, and also some residential areas, usually flats, which are intended to kind of overlook the commercial areas and to prevent that feeling of turning into a ghost town and an unsafe area after 12 o'clock at night. I'm back here in Mermaid Quay in Cardiff. And it's clearly meant to be itself an exemplar of mixed-use development, or what is termed mixed-use development. I'm right in front of the Millennium Centre on a giant plaza that's often used for theatre productions and open-air festivals. And that itself is overlooked by a block of flats, very, very familiar to people who live in cities all over the country that have been redeveloped in the last 10, 15 years. And just to the side of that, some cafes and restaurants, the Welsh Assembly Building, and all these things together are meant to fulfil the jargon of the mixed-use development. And yet, while it exemplifies the jargonistic nature of that word, it doesn't come close to the reality of Jacob's diversity or multiplicity of uses. What it really feels like is a giant leisure complex with some flats attached to it. I've just walked a short distance from Mermaid Quay and I'm now sitting on the bank of the River Taff, directly opposite a massive development of new flats, hundreds and hundreds of them, an exclusively single-use development, I would say, all with small windows and small balconies, underground parking, completely gated, so there's no public access. So the very opposite of Jacob's imagined streetscape. I can imagine these kind of flats would be used essentially for transient purposes. I can imagine people who've been dispatched from their city of origin maybe for 6 months to work on a project in Cardiff, finding the flats very convenient and useful because they've got all mod cons, they've got underground parking. They have the feeling of safety because of the gates and they're very close to the city centre. But in terms of establishing a community, I find it very difficult to imagine how that could happen because there are so few places for spontaneous encountering of other people. They don't appear to be very conducive to family life. These flats seem to be exclusively for adults to live in them for a short period of time and really for just one single purpose, which is to kind of sleep and maybe sit on the balcony. Going back to Jane Jacobs' book, looking at these flats brings about two questions for me. The first question is, what do we lose when we build places like this? And secondly, what do we prevent from happening when we build places like this? And the main possible answer to both those questions is we both lose a sense of street and we prevent a new kind of street, a new sense of street from occurring naturally. When you build high density or what appear to be high density developments such as these, you nominally have the number of people living in close enough a space to create demand for very local services. So for instance, you know, you create enough demand for a paper shop or you create enough demand for a greengrocer's. But what I sense with this development and developments like it is that they're built essentially as a dormitory within a city. I think the idea really is that you go from your flat, get into your car and then drive to the nearest shop. Now this prevents people from meeting each other in the shops if the shops were within walking distance. But it also dislocates people from all the benefits really of true high density living, which is a sense that on a street with plenty of people living on it and with enough dedication to the idea of the pedestrian and the idea of the street as a positive thing rather than a negative thing, you will actually create the conditions for economic success in that street. There'll be enough people with just enough money between them to sustain a greengrocer's, a butcher's, a baker's maybe, a card and paper shop, maybe a branch of a post office. And all these things together take a street and turn it into a real neighbourhood. And the kind of neighbourhood that Jacobs was really saying that we could all truly benefit from living in. But if we want to find a historic example of the street life that Jacobs so cherished, we haven't got to travel far. Because in many ways, the kind of neighbourhood Jacobs prized is what Cardiff Bay has been built on top of.
Tiger Bay, when you get to Loudon Square.
They're tearing down the last of the old stately houses which once surrounded Loudon Square in the heart of Tiger Bay.
At the turn of the century. Oh, I think it's sad to see the old buildings coming down. I mean, it's nice to have new accommodation, the people needed it. But very sad to see the friendliness and closeness going away.
Do you think that there's something in this community which should be saved?
There's lots that could be saved. I've been here for quite a while and I think Butte Town is one of the nicest areas I've lived in.
Adjoining Loudon Square, the first of many blocks of flats has replaced demolished houses.
Tiger Bay, Tiger Bay.
When I go to sleep at night, I sleep in the Tiger Bay I grew up in. I don't sleep in this council estate. It's only when I get up in the morning I have to face the reality that these red bricks and this orderly structure that they've put around me actually exists.
I've come to Loudon Square, which is and was the heart of the Tiger Bay neighbourhood, to the rear of where Cardiff Bay has been redeveloped. And I'm speaking to Neil Sinclair, who's a writer and historian who's written several books about the neighbourhood life of Tiger Bay. So, Neil, I've read your history of Tiger Bay, and there are some passages that absolutely struck me as being central to my quest to find out what makes neighbourhoods work and what happens when neighbourhoods are killed off, essentially, by well-intentioned planners. So if you could tell me about Loudon Square and the life of Loudon Square prior to its redevelopment.
Loudon Square acted as the focal point for the whole community. What they were destroying was an ancient, multi-ethnic, multi-generational community and imposing onto it a council estate, which would soon be called Butte Town Council Estate, but with properties were rather lackluster council estate architecture. Yeah. And having grown up with the glamour as a backdrop of Victorian, Edwardian and Georgian architecture, to see all that disappear and be replaced by nondescript type of architecture, and then all the streets that surrounded Loudon Square used to be orderly and like avenues leading to the park became mishmash. Instead of rows of houses facing rows of houses, that people every day opened their front door, left them open, and talked to their neighbours across the street, now you had rows of houses facing the backs of new houses. And squares that served no purpose, concrete squares, the grass disappeared, trees were disappearing. It was like they created a concrete jungle.
If you'd been asked, the people who lived there, then surely you would have said, well, the houses we've got, they're various, they're interesting, they're characterful, all they need... a new bathroom.
A refurbishment. But
exactly.
You know, little extensions on the back, because we all had gardens.
Lean-tos,
In the back. I mean, that would have been, ideally, that would have been the best option.
Given all the changes that have taken place in the Cardiff Bay redevelopment area in the last 20 years, who would you say the planners are deciding for and on behalf of?
Well, let's put it this way. It certainly isn't the natives of the community. After what they did in the 1960s, basically people were saying, oh, Cardiff Bay's come to finish off what the council
had started
to do in the 1960s, was to get rid of Tiger Bay. We were a community where 57 different languages were spoken every day on the street simultaneously. And all that was been swept away by the planners and the bulldozers. I think that an effort should have been made to maintain the culture, but I don't think any effort was made to say that there was a culture.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because if it had been appreciated in its own right, and if people's ways of doing things had been appreciated in their own right, then, you know, second thoughts would have been had, surely.
I think that at that particular time, it was like, let's just get rid of it.
Yeah.
It was basically...
the only way to fix things is to destroy them. Do you think that the neighbourhood life, the neighbourhood spirit of a kind that Jane Jacobs wrote about... in her own home village of Greenwich Village, is still alive in any way, and can it be integrated with the development at Cardiff Bay?
The core of our community still exists within all this new development, and when we meet on a street corner, there's still the raucous laughter and there's still the chit-chat, so it hasn't been wiped out entirely. But I can't see it being integrated into what the new future is intended to be by the powers that be, if you will, because the waterfront compared to Old Tiger Bay is lifeless by comparison. So I think we've had our moment in the sun. I am glad I was born in Tiger Bay when I was born, and I lived what I lived, because what the children have to endure today, they have no idea what paradise was really like. And in my lifetime, I lived it and I saw it. And now I'm not speaking for myself. There's so many people of my generation and older that say exactly the same thing to me. And, you know, so that's a proof that all change is not necessarily progress. So we've moved forward, and yes, our toilets and our bathrooms are inside the house instead of down the end of the garden, but life is not as rich as it used to be.
One Christmas Eve, I met a gentleman in Christina Street. He said to me, he said, good night, old Toff. I said, good night, sir. He says, where is Tiger Bay? I looked up at him and I said, you're right in the heart of Tiger Bay. He said, how is that? Well... that's just what it is. He said, to tell you the truth, I came here, I was told that I'm going to see Blood on the Moon, and I haven't seen it. So, well, while you are in it now, you know it.
Tiger Bay, it's just like a fancy dress ball, and those who can't say that they've been down the bay, well, they haven't seen Cardiff at all.
Death and Life of the Street was presented by Lindsay Hanley and the producer was Martin Williams. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handy. The final part of this three-section BBC Prom live on Radio 3 being given by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Andrew Litton. There's just one work, Prokofiev's Fourth Symphony, a piece which has only ever had one outing at the Proms until now. And like the Bach Symphony and the Bartok Concerto, it's a work that originally dates from the years around 1930. Prokofiev had put together his previous symphony out of music from his opera The Fiery Angel. The following year, he was busy writing his biblical ballet score, The Prodigal Son, for Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, when he realised, as he noted in his diary, that, hey presto, I could concoct a fourth symphony out of the ballet. He was pleased to make the discovery because he was pushed for time to write the symphony Koussevitzky had commissioned from him for use during the 50th birthday celebrations of his Boston Symphony Orchestra. The resulting piece didn't go down too well with the conductor, who thought he was being shortchanged with some regurgitated music. Both in Boston and later in Paris, the symphony wasn't a big success. Prokofiev was perplexed by the response, kept faith in what he called his simple and clear symphony, and 17 years later he rewrote it in an expanded version for specifically Soviet consumption. Not only did it become a longer piece, but it required a much larger orchestra. What it kept intact was its innate tunefulness, ideal for the requirements of the Soviet musical censors. I asked Andrew Litton whether he thinks Prokofiev was right to have a second go at the symphony.
My take on it is that he made a good decision to revise it, but I do think it's a better piece. I think he really fixed it. And I'm struck also by, in the revised number 4 that we're doing tonight, how much like Romeo and Juliet it is. Same orchestration, same harmonies, same approach, the same use of the flute, for example. Mm. And
yes, Prokofiev, the ballet composer, is a specific animal, isn't he?
Yes, yes. And so to have this symphony come out of a ballet, as it did, I think is very much a brilliant move on his part. I'd like to say that, you know, now having worked on the Fourth Symphony, I'm going to be doing it a lot. I love it. I think it's a brilliant piece.
And yeah. I was going to ask you about the end of it, which is like Shostakovich in a way. There's certainly a double-edged sword there at the end.
Very much so. It's a very bitter, twisted sort of end. I mean, it reluctantly resolves at the very last, well, the penultimate bar, finally. But I agree with you. After a lot of the levity of the earlier parts of the last movement, to have this coda that's quite horrific, actually, it's terrifying in its own way. Brilliant composer. I just think it's so wonderful that, you know, we can still find works by a great composer that deserve to be played.
Andrew Litton, Prokofiev's Fourth Symphony. Very hollow, ambiguous triumph at the end of Prokofiev's Fourth Symphony in its revised 1947 version, performed to end tonight's mega prom, given by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, led by Cleo Gould, conducted by Andrew Litton, who added in that woodblock at the end of the finale in the same sort of place it came in the first movement. He said it just made it all the more scary, that music. Perhaps that Shostakovich-like end, supposedly optimistic and heroic, but somehow the opposite, was the reason why Prokofiev's revised version of his Fourth Symphony wasn't performed in the Soviet Union until a decade after its completion. Adrian Vold from the BBC Symphony Orchestra got in 7 years earlier. And you feel that in 1947, the older, wiser Prokofiev, commenting on his rather glibber 1930 original, he said in 1947, each of us has wounds which cannot be healed. One has lost those dear to him, another has lost his health. Prokofiev's own health, after concussion following a fall, was weakened. Well, back comes Andrew Litton. He's just been recording the Liszt concertos with Stephen Huff up in Bergen, where he is music director. He's just bringing the percussion to their feet. As for the RPO, well, they're just back from Shanghai, the festival, where they've been artists in residence working with the Shanghai Youth Orchestra, as well as playing with their chief conductor, Charles Dutoit, into the residency at the Montreux Festival in September. A few weeks now, a bit more to relax. And then at the end of September, they're back at the Cadogan Hall for the start of their new season. Program of Gershwin with José Cerebrio, then off around the country on a European tour with Charles Dutoit and a certain Yuja Wang playing Rachmaninoff's second concerto. Well, Andrew Litton's going around the orchestra, bringing up each section in turn. It's just the violas and the cellos now. But time for me to say that tomorrow evening's Prom live, of course, here on Radio 3, all Russian programmes starting at 7:30, with the name on the other side of the Prokofiev coin, Shostakovich. The Philharmonia, with its principal conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen, Shostakovich, and Stravinsky's Ballet Petrushka, 1947 suite, and Tchaikovsky's Francesca da Rimini, complete and exciting programme. That's for tomorrow, but for now, with a tired but very happy audience, I think, here in the Royal Albert Hall, time for me to hand you on to Jill Anderson, back at base in Broadcasting House, to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Thank you very much. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom on Thursday afternoon at 2:15 here on Radio 3. Well, at 10:30 this evening, we'll be hearing more from BBC Radio 3's new generation artists, from two pianists, in fact. Khatia Bunyachichvili will play music by Liszt, and Benjamin Grosvenor will play works by Chopin. But for now, let's hear music by the composers featured in tonight's Prom. Firstly, music by Samuel Barber. Just after World War II had finished, he wrote one of his most treasured works, Knoxville, Summer of 1915. He set words by James Agee, nostalgic words evoking more innocent times. As Agee wrote, "We're talking now of summer evenings in Knoxville, Tennessee, in the time that I lived there so successfully disguised to myself as a child." Here's the soprano Barbara Hendricks and members of the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas, to perform Samuel Barber's Knoxville, Summer of 1915.
Spirit!
Knoxville, summer of 1915 by Samuel Barber. The soprano was Barbara Hendricks with the London Symphony Orchestra and the conductor Michael Tilson Thomas. Now, Raphael Wolfisch and John York play two arrangements of Prokofiev's music, the march from The Love for Three Oranges, arranged by Piatigorsky, and the adagio from Ten Pieces from Cinderella in Prokofiev's own arrangement.
Thank you.
Rafael Valfish played the march from Prokofiev's Love for Three Oranges, and he and John York played the adagio from Ten Pieces from Cinderella, also by Prokofiev. This is BBC Radio 3. The time is 10:30, and now we have another programme showcasing the BBC Radio 3's new generation artists. Every autumn, six or seven artists or groups who are beginning to make a mark on the music scene are invited to join Radio 3's New Generation Artists Scheme, which offers them unique opportunities to develop their talents. And these include concerts in London and around the UK, appearances and recordings with the BBC orchestras, studio recordings for Radio 3, and last but not least, appearances at the Proms. And both pianists featured tonight have already played at the Proms this year. Khatia Bunyachishvili played works by Liszt and Prokofiev at a Proms chamber music concert. And Benjamin Grosvenor played Liszt's second piano concerto at the first night and Britten's piano concerto with the National Youth Orchestra. Well, we start with a piece by Liszt, played by Khatia Bunyachishvili, who was born in Georgia and is in her second year as a new generation artist. La Lugubre Gondola is one of Liszt's most important late works. It was inspired by the death of Richard Wagner in 1883. He died in Venice, and the funeral procession to Bayreuth began with the funeral gondola to the railway station. Thank you. La Lugubre Gondola by Franz Liszt. It was played by Khatia Banyashishvili from her recent CD of music by Liszt. Our next pianist this evening is Benjamin Grosvenor, who's 19 years old and has already become an internationally recognised musician. He's played with many world-class orchestras and made recordings, and it's music from his debut CD that we'll hear now. The Scherzo No. 4 in E, Opus 54, was the last of Chopin's four scherzos and was published in 1843 with a dedication to Clotilde de Caraman, one of Chopin's pupils. Here's Benjamin Grosvenor to play Chopin's Scherzo No. 4 in E. Thank you. Benjamin Grosvenor played Chopin's Scherzo No. 4 in E, Opus 54. And that performance is on his debut CD, released this year, of music by Chopin, Liszt and Ravel. Well, let's hear some more from that CD. Here's a mixture of two composers, Chopin transcribed by Liszt. Here are My Joys and The Maiden's Wish. Thank you. Benjamin Grosvenor played two pieces by Chopin, transcribed by Liszt, The Maiden's Wish, and before it, My Joys.
The BBC Proms, a festival of extraordinary musical experiences.
The music of Johannes Brahms looms large in the 2011 BBC Proms. And this week, a celebrated interpreter of his music conducts a pair of all Brahms concerts on consecutive nights. Bernard Haitink leads the Chamber Orchestra of Europe through two Brahms symphonies and two Brahms piano concertos with Emmanuel Ax. That's Brahms with Haitink, Ax and the Chamber Orchestra of Europe at the BBC Proms, starting Friday night on BBC Radio 3 at 7 o'clock.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Now Late Junction with Verity Sharp.
There's a set of button box reels from Gabe McVarish. He's a fiddle player originally from California, but now living in the West Highlands of Scotland, and he was joined there by the box player Luke Daniels. Welcome to Late Junction. Nipping over to Canada, here's a song from Le Vent du Nord, from their latest release La Part du Feu, and it's a song called Les Métiers.
Sous ce sont les filles de Saint-Romain. Ils ont cinq ou six amas, le premier c'est un petit boiteux.
Il a la patte trop courte.
Le temps de le voir venir, seul homme en dégoûte.
Le temps de le voir venir, seul homme en dégoûte.
Le deuxième c'est un coureur, encore un métier de malheur, encore un métier de malheur.
Un métier bien viciable.
Si le chapeau vient à virer, voilà le couvreur au diable.
Si le chapeau vient à virer, voilà le couvreur au diable.
Le troisième, c'est un pêcheur. Encore un métier de malheur, encore un métier de malheur.
Métier bien viciable.
Si le chaloupe vient à virer, voilà le pêcheur au diable.
Si le chaloupe vient à virer, voilà le pêcheur au diable.
Le quatrième, c'est un cabaretier. Encore un métier de malheur, encore un métier de malheur.
Un métier bien viciable.
Si les pieds de la table viennent à manquer, voilà l'hiver au diable.
Si les pieds de la table viennent à manquer, voilà l'hiver au diable.
Le cinquième, c'est un choix de violon. C'est lui qui aura mon mignon, c'est lui qui aura mon mignon.
Qui aura ma pratique.
Lui jouera du violon, moi jouerai de la musique.
Lui jouera du violon, moi jouerai de la musique.
Thank you.
That's Apollo's Fire and two well-loved tunes, The Ways of the World and The Dusty Miller. And that's from an album that they put together from the sort of music they say that you might find while journeying through rural America in the early 19th century. And